KIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing,
Good afternoon, Phil.
And we are back in business here. We rebroadcast a couple of our programs as we are on point. We were talking about the matters to do with Syria and potential war in the Middle East. And today we're going to be talking to Sarah Flounders. She is the coordinator of the International Action Center. And Sarah has been speaking out and writing about this issue of the so-called Syria crisis and how it's being handled. So we'll be talking to Sarah. And at the halfway point, we're going to talk to Peter Rosenthal about a celebrated Toronto lawyer and fighter against war, fighter against colonialism, fighter against racism, Charles Roach. There's going to be an event on Sunday, July 22nd, at the Medical Sciences Building at the University of Toronto, and a celebration of the work of Charles Roach. And by the way, Peter Rosenthal is also a distinguished Toronto lawyer, and he has represented Charles in the big case involving Charles' refusal to swear an oath to the Queen of England, which in order to be a Canadian citizen, you have to swear allegiance to the Queen of England. So if you've come from somewhere else, which is very peculiar. So Peter will talk to us about Charles Roach and that event. And I'll just I want to thank Andrew who sent me an item. I want to make sure I just tell our listeners about it. The United States military is considering creating a new medal. And if you want to get a young man to risk his life, you create a medal. But now they've really reached a strange situation. They are going to give a medal to people called pilots of the drones. Now, you could be sitting in a trailer park in Nevada, and you have this gizmo, and you play with it like it's an electronic game. I think I'm going to object, first of all, on the level of it to being a pilot. We're supposed to say seek behind that, aren't we? He doesn't actually get in a plane and take off, which takes a certain amount of skill and nerve in order to learn how to do it. But anyhow, this has happened. The writer, lawyer, Greenfield, I think I would get his name right.
Glenn Greenwald.
Thank goodness you jumped in because I was about to say Jeff Greenfield, which would be not a nice person. Yes. Greenwald, if you just Google that name and put drone, you'll get a terrific essay on the subject. We'll probably ask Sarah Flounders about this matter as well. And we are joined by Sarah Flounders. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, thank you very much, Sarah, for joining us. You have been speaking across the United States in recent weeks, and we've seen you on Press TV and RT.com elsewhere, and waging a battle against the U.S. Approach to the so-called crisis in Syria. And, of course, that crisis right now is at this sort of point where they're talking about should there be increased sanctions, should there be intervention, and does President Assad have to leave, in the words of Hillary Clinton. What is the about the U.S. role that is not so helpful in your view?
Well, I think it's everyone who's ever opposed any U.S. war knows that this is a system that feeds on war and that lurches from one crisis to another. It needs war. It's a greatest source of profit. And this is a system that's in a glut of overproduction. I mean, the capitalist system itself, this is the center right here. And so Wall Street is always interested in and has one excuse after another for war. There's a relentless drive to reconquer and recolonize this enormously profitable region and to have strategic control of this whole vital region. And they're using every form of demonization to target one more country, to say that this is essential, that this is to save lives, that it's the right to protect, that it's a humanitarian intervention, and all of that. I think we've all heard it so many times, and we see where U.S. wars in Iraq left a third of the population dead, dismembered, or dislocated, totally uprooted refugees, homeless. We saw what it's meant in Afghanistan, continuing to this day, where they never even get the electric grid working. They've been unable to open hospitals, schools, make any progressive change for women whatsoever. So U.S. intervention and NATO intervention, with Canada right along with it, it has nothing progressive to offer. We see what it's done in Libya, just leaving modern, well-developed cities into a howling wasteland without the electric grid or the water working, and old feudal and monarchist forces coming back, fighting each other for the spoils. So this war in Syria is being directly and openly, they don't deny it, funded and supported by the U.S., by NATO, by the Arab League, which is a coalition of the most corrupt, feudal dictatorships. Here they say they're opposing dictatorship in Syria, but what on earth is Saudi Arabia, Jordan, what's Kuwait, what's Oman, you know, the United Arab Emirates? These are feudal monarchies kept in power, complete military dictatorships also, kept in power by the U.S. and by NATO, armed and equipped. So that's who's opposing Syria and orchestrating and arming this opposition and pumping in all kinds of weapons and saboteurs and also imposing sanctions to shut down the whole economy, to make it impossible for the government to pay for infrastructure or teachers or health workers or any of the things that the people had in the past. Yeah. There's open efforts to increase dissension on every level. And it's important to look at all that and to rally the anti-war movement that's opposed past wars to also oppose this one.
Yeah. We're speaking to Sarah Flounder. She's the coordinator of the International Action Center. By the way, the author of a new book that is available, PentagonAchillesHeel.com. And, Sarah, on this thing, so many of the actions, if we follow them, of the U.S., Britain, France, they get into this business representing themselves as interested in peace. But a lot of their actions, actually, if you were to put it in a proper international framework, are crimes, right? Sanctions and financing armed groups. I mean, and actually, specifically, I want to ask you about this one. We read that in Turkey there are camps where people are trained openly. They leave those camps with weapons and cross the border into a sovereign country. I mean, the United Nations has a lot of law or legislation against that, right? I mean, shouldn't the United Nations say you can't be in Turkey and be attacking a neighboring country?
Well, the United Nations certainly could and should if any of this was following international law. But you're right. Every single step of it is a crime against any form of international law. It's total piracy and international lawlessness. But because of the power of U.S. and all of the NATO countries, they simply put it forward in the most outrageous way. There have been years of sanctions against Syria. U.S. sanctions began at the time of the 2003 invasion of Iraq. We shouldn't forget Syria was on the axis of evil, the list of targeted countries by the Bush administration. And there wasn't a U.S. ambassador in Syria from 2005 until 2011, when Ambassador Ford was appointed there, who had played such an outrageously bad role. He was the aide to Negroponte, a complete war criminal. El Salvador, his bloody record is well known. Iraq, Libya. So these war criminals who are responsible for massive destruction in past wars are, as you say, organizing the very camps, equipping them, organizing the training, openly hiring international mercenaries. There have been articles again and again in the U.S. press explaining in some detail mercenaries coming from Libya, into Syria. Now, these are really just paid for, you know, soldiers of fortune, up for the next war. So all of this is being described as a Syrian opposition. Now, if the UN were playing any kind of a legal role, of course, the very idea of sanctions, of starving a whole country down, of cutting off all trade, not only U.S. sanctions, EU sanctions, and then Arab League sanctions, all that has cut off Syria, surrounded it and circled it, and then flooding in all these mercenaries and saboteurs. They make no bones about what they're doing in terms of explosions, in terms of using civilians as human shields. And then you have Hillary Clinton saying that no government with blood on their hands can remain in power. Well, I mean, who on earth has blood on their hands, right?
Did she offer to resign?
Right. And this was about demanding regime change.
Yeah.
That President Bashar Assad must step down. This is the U.S. demand. They are insisting on regime change and making it more and more costly. And then I think the other quotable quote, outrageous, in terms of showing how much Washington is willing to up the ante, said at an international meeting, demanding it of actually the European and the NATO powers, that they must make Russia and China, quote, pay the price for supporting Syria. So they're threatening
a
number of other countries.
If Russia chose to take umbrage, they would have excellent grounds. That's a threat.
Yes, it's
what you're not allowed to do, is my understanding. In international parlance, one country cannot actually make that kind of talk, is not actually permitted.
Right. This sort of talk is outside the range even of international diplomacy. Both to demand a whole government just step down and demand that every other government stop supporting the government in question, which this time is Syria. Mm-hmm. Now, but at the same time, it's also important to recognize past U.S. wars have been utter and complete disasters, failures, unable to stabilize. The destruction that they wrought, and then they pull out of Iraq because they could no longer stay. The Iraqi people made that clear. But leaving behind a ruin, an absolute ruin, and their efforts to pacify Afghanistan have been shown to be an utter failure. Libya, the highest standard of living in Africa, full literacy, free health care, just 7 months of bombardment. Every city destroyed. Mm-hmm. And the UN role in this, by the way, which this whole idea about the right to protect, it was first, we shouldn't forget, Kofi Annan, who's now heading up the peace plan for Syria, what was his role in Haiti? To simply remove the democratically elected government of President Aristide and send in UN troops at U.S. demand. So this isn't the first time it's happened.
Yeah, by the way, it'd be hard to be optimistic, even though many people are fighting for the peace plan. When you know it's Kofi Annan, you want to be very alert,
right,
based on his history.
Exactly. I mean, you wonder why Syria would accept it, but they're in the situation where anything that seems to give any respite to all-out U.S. bombardment, They would be, you know, when you have a gun at your head, you attempt to negotiate. But we've seen this all the way back. You could look at what was done in Yugoslavia, just how to divide and break up and help to foment sectarian warfare, arming one group against another.
Well, there are reports of training of some of these armed groups from Syria in Kosovo.
I would fully accept that because there are large U.S. bases today. The largest NATO base in Europe is in Kosovo. So you could picture that being as the training base where the expertise in really in deadly crimes is underway. Now, Syria, if you look at its history, over the past 50 years, had built a pretty modern secular state where all the different religious groups, sects, and whatnot lived in harmony, Sunni, Shia, Christian, and so on, and even the smaller groupings within that. But that, you could also look back to Iraq. Once the U.S. is involved, that's what they try to really tear apart.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and just to go back to sanctions a little bit, as I say, U.S. sanctions began in 2003, but and became, they lifted a little bit when Syria made a lot of concessions, opened the economy, agreed to the privatizing of all different national industries. Because really the effort of sanctions is to create shortages, wild inflation, dislocation, massive unemployment. It undermines the government's ability to pay wages and benefits and pensions and all of that. Now, 32% of the workforce in Syria are state employees. They're healthcare workers, teachers, nationalized industries, roads, infrastructure. So if you bankrupt the government, that creates enormous dislocation for the workers. And that's what it's intended to do. Now, some of the sanctions got lifted, then they were clamped down heavily again in 2010 when this whole crisis really began to heat up. 2011, the European Union imposed sanctions, and 88% of Syria's oil had been sold to the EU. So right away, that is chopped off. And then when the Arab League in 2011, November of 2011, imposed sanctions, well, half of Syria's exports are to the Arab countries. So you can see how every effort is made to shut down the whole economy. And at the same time, and this has all been sort of well reported, actually, the Washington Post in April of last year described in some detail the U.S. funneling of money to the right-wing Syrian opposition, and that that had been going on since 2005. So you have a lot of years of actually building up an opposition, funding it, sending money in, all sorts of supplies, networks. And when the this Ambassador Robert S. Ford was named, this protege of John Negroponte, the first thing he did, this wasn't even a secret, he immediately contacted the opposition. And 2 months after he is in Damascus came the first armed actions in Dara, a town on the Jordanian border, which we also hear now, it's admitted that's the main entering point for Saudi and U.S. arms. So all of this is a new wider war which is being planned, because Syria is much, much more serious than even the terrible devastation that they wrought on the African nation of Libya.
And by the way, I'm going to ask you this, sir. They are also inflaming people. I noticed the New York Times, certainly the Globe and Mail here, loves to talk about the different religious groupings and likes to highlight it as though President Assad is only the representative of one small religious grouping. They don't have any foundation, but it has a wonderful effect of creating bad blood and people seeking revenge, and all sorts of games are played. But here they're contributing by trying to highlight any difference they can find.
Absolutely, absolutely. And convincing the groups there that they would have a better deal, that they would actually rise to control, to power, if they hooked their cart, you could say, to U.S. imperialism's plan. And when this goes on over a course of years, when you have a country on the one hand sanctioned and finding it difficult to even pay, and yet secretly money is coming in, you can see how this becomes very attractive options. Now, also, let's just to even raise this Syrian National Council. That's the exile movement that the U.S. has helped to establish. It's held grand meetings in Paris, Geneva, the Friends of Syria, which is really the U.S. and NATO countries. They all recognize.
I think you've called them the enemies of Syria, right?
Absolutely. The Friends of Syria are the enemies of Syria and all the countries that are determined to bring it down. But the Syrian National Council, they're pretty open about their strategic goals. Their key spokesperson, Burhan Galyan, said, and this was quoted in the Wall Street Journal, December 2nd, 2011, said the goals are to open Syria to the West. Now, that really means the handover of resources and industries. That's what open to the West means. The second was to open to end Syria's strategic relationship with Iran and Lebanon and the Palestinian resistance. So that's really to realign. And the third was to realign Syria with the Gulf states. And that means with these reactionary feudal monarchies. So they don't hide what their, quote, democratic aspirations are. They're pretty open about it.
They have armed groups that are named after various sheikhs in Saudi Arabia, right?
Right, and they, yes, and they...
You can buy a platoon, apparently.
That's right. That's what funding, and also the flag that they fly, and even in some of the demonstrations here in the U.S., the flag that they fly is the old colonial flag.
Yeah.
You know, this goes way back.
Needs no explanation, does it?
Well, it needs a lot of explanation here because every explosion is a front page picture. It's on the evening news, and they know they're speaking to people throughout the West who have very little understanding of Syria, don't even understand, for example, what a modern and developed country it was. They have sort of very simplistic, intentionally because of the educational system here, views of the entire Arab world. And so the visuals with what a car bomb can do, with what kidnappings and death squads and explosions can do, you have people wringing their hands and and buying into the idea.
Calling something must be done.
Something must be done, right. And you also have international NGOs.
Yes, please. I'd like to. I'd like you to, if you would, speak about Amnesty and Human Rights Watch, because they always seem to show up just before the bombs fall.
Well, especially now, Amnesty International, the U.S. chapter, is now the executive director, Suzanne Nocel. She is a former State Department official who had a key role, really. In this whole question of right to protect and how to sell U.S. wars. And her coming in, I think the first time I really saw the impact of this was being in Chicago during the giant NATO meetings. Here's 60 heads of state, 10,000 different NATO between all the NATO countries, the generals, top officialdom, heads of state and their cabinets, journalists, international media, and thousands of people who went to protest NATO, really thousands, and tens of thousands of police. But what's on every bus stop, what's on traveling buses, are posters thanking NATO, keep up the progress in Afghanistan. This was a whole campaign headed by Madeleine Albright, that great humanitarian who assured us that the death of 500,000 children was worth it. When she was Secretary of State, that's what she actually said on 60 Minutes to Leslie Stahl.
And that poster is an Amnesty poster.
That's an Amnesty poster thanking NATO. Keep the progress going. And a picture of an Afghan woman. Thank you, NATO.
Endless occupation.
And not only was this the bus ad, not only was this the billboard, but this was the emails Now, there's hardly a college campus and hundreds of high schools that don't have local Amnesty International chapters. It's young people who want to campaign for human rights and political prisoners, who want to make an impact.
Mm-hmm.
They sign on with Amnesty International. And what do they get? A huge message thanking NATO, mm-hmm. applauding the war in Afghanistan. Then the next campaign was a campaign actually calling for the UN to intervene in Syria and denouncing Russia for stopping, for using their veto. That's a petition campaign. Sign online here, send a message to Russia to stop their veto. And then they had a third campaign. So this
how did they keep a straight face? I don't know.
The campaign calling on Syrian officials to be taken to the International Criminal Court and for the total freezing of all Syrian assets. And of course, they don't call for the U.S. to go to the International Criminal Court for its roles in these wars. And
English-speaking white people really are pretty much clear.
Yeah, that's exactly. So you have here this situation where probably the most prominent human rights NGO that impacts even the youngest part of the population, doing mm-hmm. big campaigns, pumping, pushing, advertising for war,
mm-hmm.
and saying this is your humanitarian obligation, mm-hmm. headed by a State Department official, Suzanne Nocel. So I think it's important for viewers to take a look at that when they mm-hmm. think, how do their perceptions arrive?
Mm-hmm.
And because really the 1%, slogan from the Occupy movement, mm-hmm. they pay their greatest attention to how to disorient the progressive, politically conscious movement. They want to overwhelm the population as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
But the politically conscious activist elements are those most likely to fight and organize and resist wars.
Mm-hmm.
And if they can be confused and disoriented and demoralized, mm-hmm. that is a whole campaign in itself. And it's why I think it's important for those of us who have some past experience with U.S. wars to speak out
mm-hmm.
and to try to connect these dots. And to say, no, there's a real propaganda disorientation campaign going on.
Well, we're speaking to Sarah Flounders, and she's the author of PentagonAchillesHeel.com, and I really hope everybody gets it. By the way, Sarah, we need these books. We need to talk to you. I assume
it's going to be out next month, but it's all there on the website.
People can start getting it now. They're going to need it. Maybe I should ask you just one last. Could you just tell us again? The U.S. seems to have crossed a kind of a Rubicon ideologically. Hillary's making these threats. They're talking about the sanctions very arbitrarily without any respect for international law. But what is driving that? One more time, if you'd just talk about it.
Well, I think the most powerful institutions in the U.S. economy and in U.S. political life today are banking, military, and oil corporations that act as one, and who also own the corporate media. Their interest is in war, and they're also the system itself is so vastly productive now that it's in constant crisis. So the guaranteed profits of militarism play a larger and larger role. They don't save the system itself, but they become more and more indispensable, like mm-hmm. speculation also does. So there is a more concerted and more ruthless effort to reconquer parts of the globe, to use war. While we're talking about Syria, we should also be addressing Iran.
Yes.
We could be addressing the U.S. encirclement and threats on China, which they tried to put in a whole missile shield around China, and it just fell through today in terms of South Korea and Japan.
Well, good. You brought us some good news.
So it's happening on a world level. What's happening in Iran, extremely serious, with the U.S. just sending in new aircraft carriers, destroyers, what are called these platform ships, punts for special forces, a fighting command center right through the Strait of Hormuz and off the coast of Iran, helicopters and all sorts of attack things. So Syria is one problem, but we should know that their plans are shaping up increasingly for war. Mm-hmm. And this is no longer even questions that are in the hands of, regardless of who's president or who's elected. They're very powerful institutions that set their own agendas. And we're pulled along in their tow unless we consciously resist.
Well, we're so grateful that you're speaking up, Sarah, and the book is PentagonAchillesHeel.com.
And that's a website, yeah.
A website.com. Right. And then from there they get the information on getting the book.
That's right. That's right. There's just the information on some of the chapters there. We're going to be updating that in the next couple of weeks. So that is a work in progress, but it has a lot of information there on Syria, on Iran, on Iraq, on past U.S. wars, on
what the
military means and environmental destruction, on a number of issues that probably be of interest to your
reader. It covers the entire topic. Thank you very, very much, Sarah.
Okay, thank you so much, Phil.
Okay, talk to you. Bye-bye. Sarah Founders, and she is the coordinator of the International Action Center. And we're going to take a break, and we will come back and speak to Peter Rosenthal. And we're back. Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. You can write to us, Taylor@CIUT.FM, and you can check our previous programs, recordings, and some articles at Taylor-Report.com. And shortly, we're going to talk to Peter Rosenthal about the celebration of the work of Charles Roach. And of course, our previous guest was Sarah Flounders. By the way, Phil, you're on the air tomorrow at.
Yes, Classical Underground on tomorrow, Tuesdays at 12 noon.
Classical Underground. I'm learning. I'm getting there. By the way, Phil, did you see this absurd article about the woman from Hamilton who's an engineer who went over and volunteered to be a leader of the...
Yes, and I really enjoyed that article because she did say at the end of it that she's quite willing to work with Israel. And I thought, well, that at least made it clear, right?
I recommend people go online and read. She's available. She gives interviews, and they get funnier by the minute. Anyway, we are joined now by Peter Rosenthal. You there, Peter?
That's true. You are joined by me. Hi.
Hey, we're really glad to have you, Peter. You are one of the key gentlemen who are participating in organizing the celebration of the work and career of Charles Roach. We want to show him how much we love him and appreciate all the great things he's been doing. And you also represent him in his really seminal case, I'm going to call this, where he is challenging the Constitution. I'll ask you to explain it, but he's saying that he should not have to swear an oath to the Queen of England in order to be a Canadian citizen. You are representing him, aren't you?
That's true. Both those things are true. I'm one of several lawyers on the oath case, but I presume most of your listeners know something about Charles Roach, but some of them may not, and those who don't should know that he's a remarkable man who's been a leading human rights lawyer in Toronto for 50 years. It's pretty impressive. And he has his own style of mixing legal arguments in courts and political arguments in the streets. And
and poetry on weekends.
That's right.
And plus an office full of beautiful paintings.
Multi-talented person. Anybody wants to see a bit of his singing and so on, just in the Google video, put in Charles Roach and watch some of the videos. It's fun. He's a remarkable man who does many things. He's also a very good artist and poet. Mm-hmm. But I think the reason that the community loves him so much is his incredibly principled fights for social justice over a period of 50 years in the courts and in the streets and so on. And he's been recently diagnosed with cancer, and it's a serious business. And he's still his wonderful, optimistic self, even in the light of that. But we definitely want to show our appreciation to him. Mm-hmm. And I hope that many of your listeners will join us in doing that. It's going to be next Sunday, that's July 22nd, beginning at 2 p.m. in the Medical Sciences Building at the University of Toronto, 1 King's College Circle, right near Queen's Park there, easy access by the Museum subway station. I sound like an ad, but I hope I am an ad that will draw people to the event. At the event itself, I should indicate, there'll be a number of speakers. Hopefully they're all going to be short and sweet, and there'll be a number of musicians also, and I understand that among these speakers will be the named person from the Taylor Report. You've heard of him, I'm sure.
That's what I heard, yes. It would be, isn't it a great thing to be able to stand up and tell Charles how much you appreciate him? I would walk on hot coals to do that.
No, yeah, absolutely, me too, yeah. I mean, personally, I've worked with him in his law firm for many years, and before I was a lawyer, he was the only person that really encouraged me to become a lawyer when in middle age I said I was thinking of doing that after being a strange kind of paralegal for many years.
And you didn't try to encourage him to become a mathematician, thank goodness.
Right. But among the other people at this event, there'll be a number of lawyers speaking, like Howard Morton, former director of the SIU, benchers like Paul Copeland and Julian Faulkner. There'll be a couple judges, and Charlie's good friend, the famous novelist Orson Clark, activists like
probably
Lennox
Canada's
Carroll,
best novelist.
Sorry?
I said probably Canada's greatest novelist.
Is that, some people would argue Margaret Atwood or somebody?
Well, she's nice. No, of course, but you know, now that we've said this, Austin Clark is a great novelist, and he did win a major prize. I can't even name it offhand, but he's known Charles and has observed Charles probably as closely as any one of us. What he has to say will be quite interesting. He once interviewed Malcolm X. I know. Well, I shouldn't say interviewed him. He was a friend of Malcolm X.
Really?
Yes.
Here we get up to talk
that's
about
why people tune in the Taylor Report. And Peter, just speaking of Charles, and again, this is going to be at 2 to 5 p.m. basically at Medical Science Building, University of Toronto, King's College Circle, celebration of Charles Roach on that Sunday, July 22nd. You mentioned 50 years of basically serving the people. If you wanted to write a history of this city and you said, well, I'm interested in the issues of race, I'm interested in issues of class, I'm interested in the struggle about colonialism and peace, you say, well, just go to Charles Roach's name and you could follow it for 50 years.
That's right. And also, he's had an important impact culturally. People may forget, young people, but older people will remember that he was one of the founders, perhaps the prime founder, of what's become the huge Caravana Festival. Yeah. In 1966, he gathered people together and started talking about such a thing and pulled it off.
He led the first Caravana March, and it was on Yonge Street.
Is that right? I don't recall.
Yeah, at a time, because he understood this to be a community event, the way they do it in Brooklyn, actually, where they actually go down the main boulevard of the city, which is what these things ought to do. But that was Charles Roach.
Well, of course, now it's going to be a huge festival. I guess it's the biggest festival in Toronto, is it?
I think it still remains that. I think you're right. So you're right. I mean, it's just phenomenal that he did that, and it sort of becomes a footnote. But if you actually really want to know who did these things, you keep coming back to his address.
Yeah, and then, you know, he has a huge number of accomplishments on the cultural front and the political, legal front. But the thing that's truly remarkable about him is his principles and integrity. You know, with this oath business, he came to Canada in 1955, and he's still not a Canadian citizen because he cannot in good conscience swear an oath to the Queen and all her heirs and successors because of several factors. He says, first off, we believe in equality of human beings. That means that no human being should swear an oath to another human being. You can swear an oath to a principal or to a country or to a government or something, but not to a human being. Yeah. And secondly, he points out that his ancestors were enslaved by her ancestors. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, on the other hand, I didn't know until recently, actually, Charlie has some Irish ancestors in his background, too, and he says,
you can't win for losing.
They were colonized by the Queen's ancestors. So mm-hmm. on both sides, his ancestors were mistreated by the same royalty that's represented by Queen Elizabeth. And it's really quite astonishing when you swear allegiance to the Queen in the oath of citizenship, it's to not only her, but her heirs and successors. So if one of her successors becomes a slave owner again,
yes,
you have sworn allegiance. Now, most people would say, well, what's the big deal, Charlie? Just, you know, mumble the oath and get done with it. But Charlie is a very principled man. He says, if I take an oath, I have to stick by it. And I don't want to stick by that oath. I want to fight for a Republican Canada. I don't want to defend the Queen.
Well, good.
And, you know, it's only recently that I fully began to appreciate the importance of that case. I really do believe in it now. Charlie's a very determined person. He started that case in the early 1990s in federal court, and he lost at the trial division, and then he lost in the Court of Appeal, the Federal Court of Appeal. And then he tried to appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada, and they denied leave to appeal. So that seemed to end it. Mm-hmm. Sometime in 1995 or 6. But then, some years later, he decided to try again. And he tried again, launching a case in the Ontario Superior Court of Justice. And, of course, the Attorney General argued, that's been decided years ago. Forget it. But mm-hmm. Charlie pursued and got the courts to rule that he should be given another shot at it, that chartered jurisprudence has evolved since then, mm-hmm. and there should be a shot at it. So, and then that was attacked again recently, but a couple months ago we won the right to continue it. So now we definitely have the right to continue it, and we want to bring it on quickly now if we can mm-hmm. and get down to the merits, and it's a very interesting case.
It's certainly.
Know, other aspects of it that Charlie pointed out is that the Queen must, by constitutional convention, must be an Anglican. Mm-hmm. Can't be a Muslim, a Jew, an atheist, a Catholic. Yep. And is it really reasonable to have Canada's multicultural society headed by a person who must, by constitution, be Anglican? It's pretty remarkable when you think about it.
It's embarrassing.
It is embarrassing. You know, in Australia, which has the same sort of constitutional structure in relation to the Queen as we do, there's been a Republican movement that was pretty strong down there, but and it failed. I mean, they still are a constitutional monarchy. They still have the Queen as their Queen. But their citizenship oath doesn't require you to swear any allegiance to the Queen. You just swear allegiance to the country and to obey the laws and so on.
The only thing would be rational, not that the oaths are a good thing, but it would only be rational to say, I'll uphold the law.
Right.
But for crying out loud.
But it's not a requirement of our Constitution or anything that you swear an oath to the Queen. It is a requirement of our Constitution that the Queen be the head of state. So to change that is a much more major undertaking. We can't do that by a clever charter argument. But the oath itself is just part of the Citizenship Act. It's just an ordinary law, and it could be changed, as it was in Australia, to just be an oath to uphold the law, not to another human being. And that's what we're asking the court to do. And I really applaud Charlie for hanging in there with all this. You know, he was interviewed recently on TV, and he said about his illness. He doesn't know how long he has to live, maybe 18 months or something, and the reporter then sort of asked him, you know, why are you putting so much energy into this case then? He says, I fight for human rights. I'm going to keep fighting for human rights as long as I can. That's Charlie Roach.
Yeah. I'm glad you recited that story. Peter, we thank you very much. So it's going to be 2 p.m., and it's going to be at the Medical Sciences Building. It's a celebration of the work of Charles.
2 p.m. Next Sunday.
Yes, Sunday, July 22nd at 2 p.m.
And we hope all people who recognize Charlie's importance to the city come and show our appreciation to him.
Well, you really laid it out very nicely for us, Peter. Thank you very much.
Thank you for asking me. Bye.
Bye-bye. That's Peter Rosenthal, University of Toronto Mass Professor, a celebrated lawyer in his own right. He's with the firm of Roach Schwartz and Associates, and he is he and Charles have done a lot of remarkable work together. And full disclosure, I've worked with Charles Roach on a number of cases. I've traveled. I found myself in airports in Holland and in Nairobi, and I'm sitting with a lawyer who the first question is, "How's Charlie?" That's what. So he's a beloved Canadian individual, quite well known throughout our hemisphere. We didn't even mention the Lawyers Guild in the U.S., which Charles has been very active with. Ramsey Clark, whom we've had on this program, is a very close friend and admirer of Charles. And by the way, Tiki Clark is going to be singing at this event. So at any rate, in the some time remaining, we were talking, Phil, about this woman who was went off. What I'm interested in is this. The Globe and Mail of July 13 gave her this coverage, and she'd been talked about, I think, in a National Post. Anyway, she was just a photo op, and she's from here, apparently, and she goes over, and she goes to a camp in Turkey where she puts on a gun and battle dress. By the way, that is against the law. It's against Turkish law. The United Nations is supposed to say you cannot be in a refugee camp and walk around with a gun. And incidentally, if she were to have shown up in the West Bank and said, "I'm here to support the Palestinians," that would have been her last trip. So we ought to knock off all this stuff about freedom fighting and all that. You cannot support the Palestinians and their struggle without being subject to oppression, police surveillance, and every other kind of harassment. But you can get on an airplane, fly to Turkey, wave a gun, give a speech, and everybody says, "Isn't that wonderful? That's very touching." You know what would take courage now here for a Syrian Canadian would be to defend his country or her country, to speak up, because they would be on your case. This idea that, oh, finally they can say something, that's a lie. No, a Syrian couldn't actually safely here honestly say that they think, you know, they really don't appreciate these guys, these armed groups shooting place up. Rightly or wrongly, doesn't matter, but you could not say that. You have to be on side, and then they'll call you a freedom fighter. So happily, she kept talking, and eventually she said a few things, which everybody started to blush. And so we understand that she's going to come back and join us again. We've had to live with this hypocrisy. There's a story on the Cubans front, by the way, that I want to make sure we mention. The Cuban consul has been prevented from visiting. He was denied a visit from, I got to get the names right here. Gerardo Hernandez, legal team, is preparing new documents, and he's engaged in the last phase of his legal appeals. He's one of the members of the Cuban Five who are trying to prevent aggression against their country by providing intelligence, which they turned over to the FBI, and then the FBI arrested them for turning over the intelligence. At any rate, U.S. authorities have intervened, and last Saturday, Gerardo was denied a visit from the Cuban consul, and on Monday, his attorney, Martin Garbus, was delayed entry to see him for several hours. Garbus was eventually allowed to meet with Gerardo, but was denied the right to bring him a crucial documents that he needed to review with Gerardo. He was even denied the right to bring pencil and paper to the visit. This is an American prison. This is, you know, Hillary gets up every morning and lectures the world about freedom and their rights of people, particularly accused people around the world. But the lawyer for one of the Cuban Five can't even go to see his client. First, he's delayed, and then they don't let him take pencil and paper. This is a superpower. If you're a superpower, how come you act so scared? It might be a medicinal question to be put to them. I'll tell you again, you're listening to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. We spoke a while ago with Sarah Flounder about this question of the Syria. And there is something called the Syrian National Council. And Phil, there's some individuals there. Let me ask you, You reviewed some of the names. Can you give me an account of some members of the Syrian National Council that appeared in The Guardian recently?
Well, this is a very detailed article in The Guardian of July 13th by Charlie Skelton. It's called The Syrian Opposition, Who's Doing the Talking? And the article doesn't take a pro-Assad position. It says that, you know, that people might have an issue with this government. But let's ask the questions, who are these people who say they speak for the opposition? So one of the names they come up with is a woman in Paris named Basma Kodmani. And she has a very interesting CV because she seems to change nationality as suits the purpose. She's now referring to herself as a Syrian.
She used to be French.
But she used to be a French diplomat, right? But now all of a sudden she's a member of the Syrian opposition. She evidently was born there, but of course many people become citizens of France, and she's been living in France. She's been at the Bilderberg conference twice, right? Now, that is not a conference where...
I didn't get an invitation, did you?
No, we've never gotten an invitation to Bilderberg, right? Nor do we anticipate any for the Taylor Report anytime soon.
Probably not.
She was listed as French at the 2008 conference. In 2012, she appears in their catalog as international. Her homeland is now the world of international relations. She doesn't have a nationality. She's international.
And she's a spokesperson for the Syrian resistance.
For the Syrian National Council. She is...
Based in London.
Based in Paris. She's based in Paris. But she might as well be based in London because the article makes clear that she is fully trusted by the Americans and the Brits. So that's
apparently based on what Sarah Flounder says, she'll definitely be respected by Amnesty, since they now have a former State Department person running their Amnesty.
There is a very interesting name pops up here. There's a foundation in Washington, and Phil, this is a name.
Oh, this one I want
you to remember. There's a group in Washington that are called the Henry Jackson Society. And that's the guy we used to call the senator from Boeing, right?
Yes.
The late Senator Henry Jackson never
Scoop Jackson.
He never saw a bomber he didn't want to build or a place he didn't want to drop one of his bombs on. Right. And so now now that he's passed this mortal coil,
he's a champion of human rights.
Absolutely.
What's the name of this guy?
And he's got the international patrons of the Henry Jackson Society, all of whom are involved. The main guy is a guy named Michael Weiss. Who says military intervention in Syria isn't so much a matter of preference as an inevitability. Well, and of course he's speaking for the Henry Jackson Society.
Yes.
And the patrons of the society include James Woolsey, once a CIA boss, Michael Chertoff, who was the Homeland Security chief under Bush, William Kristol, Robert Kagan, Joshua Bomb Iran Muravchik, as his nickname is Bomb Iran, right? And Richard Pearl, known as the Prince of Darkness.
And Mr. Weiss of the Jacksons.
That's right.
Scoop Jackson.
And he's fronts for those guys, right? Now, one of the things the article does go into is the so-called Syrian Observatory for Human Rights.
Oh, I love
which
that.
We all
tell
agree.
Us, read that part.
This is a fantastic title for whoever heard of a political organization called an observatory.
It gets quoted in New York Times, Globe and Mail, Toronto Star, a lot.
Yeah. And it turns out it's being run by one guy in a tailor shop in London. But the justification for the inevitable military intervention is the savagery of President Assad's regime. The atrocities, the shelling, the human rights abuses. Information is crucial here, and one source above all has been providing us with the data. It is quoted at every turn. The head of the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights told Voice of America that fighting and shelling killed at least 12 people in Homs province. So they tried to find out, the author of this article, well, who is it? What is the observatory? But who are they? They are Rami Abdulrahman, who lives in Coventry. I said London. Sorry about that. According to a Reuters report in December of last year, when he isn't fielding calls from international media, Abdulrahman is a few minutes down the road at his clothing shop, which he runs with his wife. That's it, folks. There's a Syrian observatory observing all the violence in Homs from Coventry, England.
Yes, and the editorial writers review his information from his laundry or whatever it is, and then tells you why we need to take action. And he's sitting in England.
Right.
Yeah.
In Coventry, which because I find ironic. That's the place you used to send people to shut them up, right?
Yeah, you go send him to Coventry. Yeah. The name again, the fellow, is it Michael Weiss?
Michael Weiss, yeah. Weiss,
okay.
Weiss, yeah.
Well, I want to share this with our listeners. The last time I heard him, and I heard him more than once, was on that the CBC sassy as it happens. And they featured him. And I thought, who is this? This is some American wise guy who, using words like it's inevitable that they're going to take action against a sovereign country. And they loved him. And they were respectful. And he's working, as you say, for Mr. Pearl and a whole gaggle of Bush and Obama bombers, people who advocate aggression against countries all over the world. But he was featured. I'm going to put him on notice. He ain't going to be on the Taylor Report, that's for sure.
You know, another name that comes up that we all recognize, George Soros, the author of all the color revolutions that brought democracy to
Daddy Warbucks.
To Georgia and Ukraine. But, you know, actually, that's almost hopeful that he's involved because all of his color revolutions all faded, didn't they? They kind of didn't quite work out for Mr. Soros the way he had hoped they would. And maybe he has the Midas touch for the Syrians, you know.
Yeah. No, they all have this quality that Sarah Flounder spoke of. They're uninhibited, humanitarian interventionists. They found this word, this expression, and it'll justify any aggression. Hey, I have to cite something from about the War of 1812. Toronto Star did a big spread yesterday about the first battle, Michilimackinac, in July of 1812. And they have a quote here. They seem comfortable with it. The quote says, "If a single Indian should be killed before the fort, it would be impossible to protect them, the people in the fort, from the fury and thirst for blood." That was a common British technique. They had native allies. They spoke for them. There isn't no native signed that. That's a threat to wipe out everybody. They did it at Detroit. And in the case of Fort Dearborn, they actually did have a massacre. But what's striking about it is that Native Americans are being represented by a British officer threatening everybody, but we're not told the thoughts or opinions of those natives who, of course, lost the whole shooting match, everything. And the British did not stand by them, sold them down the river. They were not represented at the Ghent Treaty when they ended the war. There were no native was represented, though all of their land went by the boards. But the British, meanwhile, when they were engaged in the war, and it's a British-American war, there were no Canadians represented at Ghent either, they were never doing the speaking themselves. The commander named Tecumseh had a reputation actually for opposing massacres. That is, he didn't like to see civilians harmed, and that wasn't his intention. But when the British commanders wrote, they wrote as they were using the threat of annihilation in order to try to achieve some victories. They did, by the way. They did have some victories. But to see the Toronto Star happily quoting that without saying, no native said that. That's a British officer said it. And that wouldn't be anything to be proud of, to say, you know, something happens here. I can't guarantee you they won't kill the women and children. I would say, and who are you again? Why don't you turn your little canoes around and go home if you're going to talk about annihilating people, which is what they were doing. So anyway, I find that curious, and it pops up in all the journals these days. It's amusing. They think because it happened in the 19th century, they can talk this way and be proud of it. Anyhow, you've been listening to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. You can write to us, Taylor at CIUT. FM, and check us out, Taylor-Report.com. I want to thank Phil Conlon, thank Carol, and we'll see you next week.